Welcome again to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm Justine Ward, your host, and we are starting the new year with crime classics. Today we have 2 half-hour shows from the Crime Classics series, which debuted in 1953 on CBS. The show is hosted by an understated announcer called Thomas Highland, played by actor Lou Merrill. Composer Bernard Herrmann added many layers of music and sound effects. Herrmann is well known for creating a lot of the music that Alfred Hitchcock used in his productions. Elliot Lewis, actor, producer, and director of Suspense, Broadway Is My Beat, and On Stage, produced this series. Lewis and the writers Morton Fine and David Friedkin researched and crafted these fine stories. Let's begin with the first episode of Crime Classics, The Crime of Bathsheba Spooner, first broadcast June 15, 1953 on CBS.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. Listen. The man in nondescript uniform dropping stones into that well is a mercenary soldier, more recently a deserter. He's testing the depth of the well, the only way he knows, since a length of rope is not immediately available, and more complicated machines are as yet undiscovered. This is the year 1778, and the deserter is named James Buchanan. Next to him is his friend, another deserter whose name is William Brooks. These men are in the employ of Mrs. Bathsheba Spooner of Brookfield, Massachusetts, whose well it is. Mrs. Spooner will pay these men immediately they deposit the body of her murdered husband, right down there. And tonight, my report to you on the crime of Bathsheba Spooner, the first woman to be tried for murder in the United States.
Crime Classics, a new series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Thomas Highland.
The place is Brookfield, Massachusetts, the year 1778. Scene? The home of Joshua and Bathsheba Spooner, a large and respectable dwelling, two stories in height, situated on the north side of the road from Brookfield to Worcester. In the front of it and nearly opposite on the south side of the road are stately elms and a well. And in the living room, there's this.
What manner of woman are you, Bathsheba? There's no content in you and no happiness.
And what happiness have you given me? A life that dies quickly. Cooking and sewing. And from you, drunken sleep.
And you've not answered me. You would like to see me dead, would you not?
Listen to me, Joshua. When you returned this morning from Worcester, my heart sank in me. I'd hoped you wouldn't come back.
That I would have an accident. That in some way I would be killed.
Yes.
That you would be free then.
Yes.
To walk the town. Newly widowed with a wandering eye.
Yes.
And you listen, shrew. I am your husband, and I am your lover, and that's the way things are.
Old man! Old man! Ezra? Ezra?
I've been waiting. Bathsheba.
Wait.
No more waiting, Bathsheba. The time I was away from you, with your husband in Worcester. The thinking about you.
And there'll be more waiting. Until it's done. Until you kill him.
I tried, but I could not.
He asked me a question, my husband did. What manner of woman are you, he asked. Now I wonder. What manner of woman am I to love such as you, a youth? A boy who pretends to manhood. You, without the courage to...
The poison you gave me. There was no opportunity, Bathsheba.
And a boy who lies. Opportunity. When it becomes nighttime, my husband becomes a drunkard. You know that. To empty the poison in the cup when you were with him, a simple thing like that, you couldn't do.
I swear it to you, Bathsheba. He'll die.
When? Go to him now. to the tavern where he is. Empty the poison.
I threw the poison away.
With no courage.
Bathsheba.
Speak my name and bedevil yourself with it.
Just kiss me, Bathsheba.
No kisses. No secret whisperings. None of that. No more. Until my husband is dead. Laugh then, you'll see I mean it.
There's a wench, Bathsheba, at the other end of town. And she watches me when I walk by.
Then go to her.
All right.
Wait. Don't leave me.
You almost let me go.
Boy, you...
Bathsheba.
Kill him. Kill my husband.
Later.
And that was Bathsheba Spooner. You've come to know her pretty well. You've seen her hating, you've seen her loving. There's more you should know. She was the sixth child of an illustrious man, General Ruggles. The general was a man of great wealth and lived in a style of unusual luxury for that day. He kept 30 horses and had a park of 20 acres for deer and a pack of hounds for the amusement of numerous visitors. He was a man intensely loyal to the British crown and never hid his loyalties. And so, at the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, he was forced to give up his estate and to leave the country. His married life was also pretty bad, and he and his wife did not set a good example to his children in their conjugal relations. Bathsheba sprang from that kind of a household. Her loyalist background in time of war, and the very fact of the name she had, Bathsheba, were sufficient cause for the town in which she lived to view her with alarm. But keep this in mind. Bathsheba Spooner is going to murder her husband. How? Well, let's see how time and motive and circumstance conspire to get a man violently dead. The man, Joshua Spooner. Let's pick him up and see what he's doing. It's the same evening, and since it's after dark, he's drinking. And in Brookfield, there's only one public house in which to drink, Cooley's Tavern. And that's where he is.
Oh, no, doctor.
Eh?
Then what would you do?
To trap General Burgoyne? Very simple. Hand me your tankard, Dr. King.
Here.
Now, and here, this spoon, the line of march of Burgoyne.
Uh-huh.
And your tankard and mine, two sections of the troops of General Washington.
Uh-huh.
Now watch.
And that's how we take care of General Burgoyne.
Yeah. Barkeep, more ale.
Joshua Spooner talks of strategies and drinks his ale. But mark this. Near the bar, another table. Two men. Men in nondescript uniforms. Deserters from the army of General Burgoyne. Their names? James Buchanan and William Brooks. They've made known the fact that they've deserted the enemy, so their drinks are on the house and the appreciative customers. They're having a fine time.
Drink your ale, Will. Make me a toast and I'll drink with you.
And a toast you shall get. Burgoyne is a scurvy...
Louder, Will, louder, else we'll pay for our own ale.
Aye. A toast. Aye, I'll give you a toast to that scurvy, plump, bellied Burgoyne. May he rot in the wilderness.
That is if he don't drown coming across the St. Lawrence.
Gentlemen.
And a merry evening to you.
Joshua Spooner is my name, and it would do me proud if you would permit me.
Ale is what we're drinking, sir.
Ale for the patriots!
And patriots we are, indeed, to goodness.
Oh, yes. We joined General Washington, sir, and his colonials. You should know that. And from here, we go to Worcester, where a column of Washington's heart is a... Oh. Ale. To you, sir, and thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Willibach, your tankard is dry, and so is mine.
If you will permit me, gentlemen, it would be my pleasure. My pleasure indeed.
Yes. It would be Mr. Spooner's pleasure indeed to buy the lads more ale, as was the custom. True, it was 1778, but the etiquette was the same. Nothing too good for our boys. And the deserters in Cooley's bar were off to join our boys. As a matter of fact, it was Mr. Spooner's pleasure to direct James Buchanan and William Brooks to Worcester to become soldiers in Washington's army. It just happened that one of the landmarks that Mr. Spooner gave the lads went something like this.
Now, mark you, a file of elms and a well, and across the road from it, my house. When you pass there, you'll be leaving Brookfield, and you will know you're on your way. We'll have another ale before you leave.
You're a gentleman if I ever met one.
Oh, a true one, James, my lad. A real gent.
So they touched tankards, the deserters and Joshua Spooner, and they made tearful farewell. And the deserters left and walked the road toward where the elms were, and a house, and a well. Let's go on ahead of them. Let's get back to the lady. Bathsheba's home. Bathsheba's fixing her hair. And the youth Ezra? He's tying into it night ribbons. A lover's tender gesture. Their talk, however, is shocking.
Perhaps you're right. Perhaps the best way is not to poison him.
I say shoot him.
Perhaps, in such a way as to make it appear as an accident. Will you shoot him, Ezra? Tightly with the ribbon, dear. Ezra?
I have not the courage for it.
But you know of guns and shooting. You were in the army for a year.
I marched. I shot no one. I marched upon an ambush and was wounded. Myself, I never pulled a trigger.
If not you to kill him, Ezra, then someone.
Yes. Turn from your mirror, Bathsheba, and look at me.
Oh, listen. Do you hear?
Yes. Drunkards.
Someone. Go to the window.
Drunkards. Two of them by the moon. British deserters. I've seen them in town.
Call to them.
Bathsheba.
Call to them.
Hello! You there!
What do you want?
I'll talk to them.
A lady wants to talk to you.
A lady? At the lady's service any time.
Let them in, Ezra.
The Bathsheba Spooner who greeted the deserters must have been quite a sight. Tall, long hair, and blue ribbons. There must have been a fire in the fireplace, and in all probability she was standing in front of it. Her manner was gracious, and she was smiling. Ezra served the liquor. All in all, it was the nicest thing that could possibly have happened to two fellows who had deserted General Burgoyne.
And now, gentlemen, a question.
We bow. Bow, James, my lad. Say on, my lady.
How would you gentlemen like 500 pounds to see you on your long journey?
Mir Hanult would warm the cockles, wouldn't it, Will?
It would. Does that answer you, my lady?
And what would you do for it?
There is nothing that Will and I have not done, and for less handsome payment from less handsome women.
Far less.
Kill my husband.
This lad, the one you call Ezra.
Come here, lad. The next skinny ones don't take long for twisting.
Bathsheba!
Not him. Not Ezra.
Not him, James.
Then who?
My husband will return from his drinking. Will you wait for him? Kill him? When he returns, meet him outside at the door and greet him. Will you?
Not only for the money, dear lady, but for the pleasure of your presence to two tired soldiers. Right, Jane?
It's the truth.
You be the master of this house.
Yeah. And you are the two...
That we be.
This one was a struggler, eh, Will?
Get the woman. The one she calls Ezra.
Aye.
Mrs. Spooner, come see. It is done.
And a tidy job, if I say so myself, Mrs. Spooner.
And now he's dead.
What will you do with him?
There's a well across the road.
Ah. Give us angines. And you, Ezra.
I'll walk with you.
It's a deep well.
Poor little man.
And that's how Joshua Spooner died. And that's how Bathsheba Spooner killed him. You are listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Hyland. Later this evening, the Lux Summer Theater stars Fred McMurray in a full-hour adaptation of the romantic mystery comedy, The Lady and the Tumblers. An odd triangle composed of a beautiful girl, a suitcase full of explosive letters, and a murdered man will make The Lady and the Tumblers' most unusual dramatic fare. Listen to it on most of these same stations later this evening when CBS Radio presents the Lux Summer Theater. And now, once again, Thomas Hyland and the second act of Crime Classics, and his report to you on the crime of Bathsheba Spooner. Listen to this. It's awful and dread, this tale that I tell. Joshua Spooner lies dead in a well in Brookfield Town in 78... from six stout whacks across the pate. Small poem by an anonymous contributor to the Worcester Spy, the local newspaper of the day. A change of scene now. Across the road from a cold well into a warm living room. Tableau, four people.
Mr. Spooner was such an elegant man. What will become of his clothes in his closet and his horse?
You may have them.
Come away from the window, Bathsheba. Here, to me, close.
The stars are dancing.
You're shivering. Are you cold?
No.
Will is very weary, Widow Spooner. We'll not go on to Worcester tonight.
Then wait till morning. You can make a place for yourselves in the barn.
But the money we'll have now. And the clothes and yours.
Yes, all of it. Ezra.
Yes?
In the morning, you will go to Cooley's Tavern. Inquire of Joshua. Tell them he's not been home. Tell them I'm frantic for his welfare.
Yes.
Good night, gentlemen. A very good night.
Mr. Cooley.
Aye? Cut grog on a nippy morning, Mr. Ross.
I've been sent to inquire of Joshua Spooner.
Who sent you?
The wife of him, Bathsheba.
Did she now? And why?
Last night he did not return home, and Mrs. Spooner is frantic for his welfare.
Not home? Well, he's not here. Last night he sat right there, my lad, and discussed military strategies with the doctor. Then, to the best of my knowledge, he went home.
Dr. King. Doctor. Doctor, wake. Wake up. Please, Doctor, wake up. It's important.
What is it? What?
Where is Joshua Spooner?
Where is he?
Mr. Cooley says he sat with you last night.
As he did, he did. And left me.
He's not home.
What?
Mrs. Spooner sent me to fetch him. She's troubled that he's not returned.
But where else could he have gone if not to his wife?
We must find him, Doctor.
Yes, by all means.
Ezra did that very well, with the precise shading of alarm in his voice, the concern. A man on an errand for a troubled lady. Everybody was impressed. Mr. Cooley closed his bar. Dr. King appealed to the neighborliness of the other customers, and everybody went looking for Joshua Spooner. Immediately, they called on Mrs. Spooner, whom they found in the greatest apparent distress. Upon an examination of the premises, in the neighborhood of the doorstep, they observed the tracks of several persons on the snow. And, on further search, they found Mr. Spooner. You know where. In the well. So far, only horror and suspicions. But now, let's pick up Willie and James. They haven't left Brookfield. Stupid of them, isn't it? But then you've got to examine it from their point of view. Why become soldiers in Washington's army, especially in the winter, and suffer the privations of the military, when they could be warm and rich as a civilian? So, imagine it. Two tatterdemalion deserters, suddenly elegant, in Mr. Spooner's clothes, which were somewhat tight-fitting. But elegance and tight-fitting are somehow akin. Now, there lived in Brookfield a certain wench whose name is lost in history. This much is known about her. She had an eye for tight elegance. This much is known about her, too, that she went riding with Willie and James on their newly acquired horse.
I'll help you down.
Now, James, no.
Give us a bus, dearie. Ah, that's a dearie.
Will?
Aye.
How is it we are riding Mr. Spooner's horse?
Why, dearie, we don't know a Mr. Spooner.
Aren't these Mr. Spooner's silver buckles?
No.
Aren't you wearing his clothes?
These are our clothes, dearie. Come, let's ride some more. It brings the pink to your pretty cheeks.
But the cat was out of the bag. The girl told her mother, and her mother her father. And it so happened that her father was at that moment on his way to look for the murderers of Joshua Spooner. So the father told some neighbors, and they located James and Willie. Brought them all together. The two deserters, Ezra and Bathsheba. And this is what happened.
The jurors for the government and people of Massachusetts Bay in New England, upon their oath, present that William Brooks and James Buchanan and Ezra Ross in the county of Essex, not having God before their eyes, an assault did make upon Joshua Spooner, feloniously, willfully, and of their malice aforethought, on the first day of March last past, with force and arms also by striking, beating, and kicking aforesaid Joshua Spooner, so as to inflict several mortal bruises, of which Joshua Spooner died. And that Bathsheba Spooner, widow and late wife of Joshua Spooner, being seduced by the instigation of the devil, did incite, move, abet, counsel, and procure the murder of aforesaid Joshua Spooner. How do you plead?
Not guilty.
Not guilty?
Not guilty.
What statement have you, Bathsheba Spooner?
I am the wife of the deceased. If what you accuse me of be true, what end could the death of my husband serve? Were there any reasons, persuading, hopes, inviting, or advantages arising from the death of my husband? By depriving myself of husband, I would subject myself to the burdens of a widow. If I hated my husband, as such has been said, could I not have separated from him, gone to my father or to my brothers? What foolishness is this to say I've loved Ezra Ross, when one of my station might have any gallant I please? Gentlemen, if I be guilty, I was not of sound mind.
To the sheriff of our county of Essex, greetings. We command you that on Thursday, the 4th day of June next, between the hours of 12 and 4 of the clock in the afternoon, you cause William Brooks, James Buchanan, Ezra Ross, and Bathsheba Spooner to be conveyed from our jail, where they are now in your custody, to the usual place of execution, and there to be hanged by the neck until their bodies be dead.
The motive, the crime, and the sentence. Justice was simple. And quickly, too quickly for the four prisoners, the 4th day of June. This is a copy of the Worcester Spy dated that day that I have here. I'd like to read from it. It was about 2:30 of the clock in the afternoon when the four criminals were brought out of prison and conducted to the place of execution under a guard of 100 men. The three men went on foot. Mrs. Spooner was carried in a chaise, being then, as she had been for several days, exceedingly feeble. The procession was regular and solemn. Just before they reached the place of execution, one of the most terrific thunderstorms that had occurred within the memory of the oldest inhabitant darkened the heavens. There followed an awful time. The loud shouts of the officers amidst the crowd of 5,000 people, the horses pressing upon those in front, the shrieks of the women in the tumult and confusion, the malefactors slowly advancing to the fatal tree, preceded by the dismal coffins, the fierce coruscations of the lightning athwart the darkened horizon, quickly followed by loud peals of thunder, conspired together and produced a dreadful scene of horror. It seemed as if the author of nature had added such terrors to the punishment of the criminals as might soften the stoutest heart of the most obdurate and abandoned. At length, the place of execution having been reached, Ross, Buchanan, and Brooks ascended the ladder to the stage.
Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Ross made an audible prayer. The other two were engaged in silent devotions until they faced the noose. Mrs. Spooner, as she approached the tree, was seen to bow gracefully to many of the spectators with whom she had been acquainted. Then she crept up the ladder on her hands and knees. When the eyes of the malefactors were covered and all was ready, Mrs. Spooner took the sheriff by the hand. And for the first time, Bathsheba Spooner accepted the verdict of justice.
My dear sir, I am ready. In a little time, I expect to be in bliss. And but a few years must elapse when I hope I shall see you and my other friends again.
That's the way the newspaper recorded it. This has been my report of the crime of Bathsheba Spooner, the first woman tried and executed for murder in the United States.
In just a moment, Thomas Hyland will tell you about next week's Crime Classic. The National Blood Program has been made part of the Department of Defense. That's how vital a continuing growing stockpile is against emergencies of war or peace. In the warm weather months, donations fall off. In the first week of June alone, donations drop 20%. This must be offset immediately. Before you go away, please phone the Red Cross for an appointment to give a pint of blood. You will enjoy your vacation more for having done it. And here again is Thomas Hyland.
Next week, we'll be with you at the same time, although geography and year will change. The place? Pimlico, England. The year, 1879. My report? On the shockingly peaceful passing of Thomas Edwin Bartlett, greengrocer. Thank you. Good night.
Bathsheba Spooner, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin.
The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program was produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. Bathsheba Spooner was played by Mary Jane Croft. The cast included Herb Butterfield, Sam Edwards, William Johnstone, Georgia Ellis, Tudor Owen, and Ben Wright. Bob Lamond speaking. Stay tuned now for Gary Moore with Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. And remember, for mystery mixed with merriment, join Mr. and Mrs. North Tuesday evenings on the CBS Radio Network.
You are listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm Justine Ward, your host. And next, we have another episode of Crime Classics for your enjoyment. This is the story of an early 18th century murder where the victim's head was encased in glass by a master glassblower to preserve the evidence. Travel with me to England in the early 1700s and listen to Crime Classics. John Hayes, His Head, and How They Were Parted. Broadcast September 28, 1953 on CBS.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland with another true story of crime. Listen. The glass you just heard broken was not ordinary glass. It was a closed vessel of exact contour of the man's head which it held. It was raised exactly 1 millimeter above the skin all around and above the hair. No small feat, since the hair on the head was lush and curly. Another masterpiece by Dom Llewellyn, whose secret of blowing glass to enclose human heads died when he died. Dom Llewellyn had been called in to do a job of work on what was left of Mr. John Hayes, which was all above the neck. So tonight, my report to you on John Hayes, His Head, and How They Were Parted. Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now once again, Mr. Thomas Highland. The 18th century was only a few years old, and the town was Warwick, and the season was spring. Things were budding all around, trees, flowers, and there happened to be a 16-year-old girl named Catherine Hall. She appears suddenly in history, this girl walking down the road. Suddenly, because nobody knows what parentage put her there. Isn't that nice? A young girl swinging down a road in May. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la- nuts. And alongside her, three soldiers, officers of His Majesty's Dragoons, and gentlemen. Gentlemen three, and guardians of Catherine, and Lieutenant Ombersley has the papers in his bandolier to prove it. Guardians and their ward at a crossroad.
Catherine?
Yes, Uncle?
Uncle Fred and Uncle Ned and I think the time has come...
For what, Uncle?
The time has come...
Do not be shy. How is it that always you are shy when the sun shines?
We have a wedding gift for you.
Uncle?
From all of us to you.
Uncles?
The gift, here. A scarf.
Uncles?
We'll miss you.
And I you.
And the time now to tell you of him, of the man you will marry. Of the man who comes down this road anon to take you from us, from Uncle Fred and Uncle Ned and myself.
Is he as tall as you?
He is very rich.
Is he as handsome as Uncle Ned?
He is very rich.
And has he the strength of Uncle Fred?
He is very rich.
Then I know I shall love him well.
Catherine?
Yes, Uncle.
Your duties as wife?
Yes, Uncle.
Always water in the pail, and loving nuptials cannot fail.
And?
Happy marriage in a springtime day. Child in the cradle on New Year's Day.
Oh, yes, Uncle. Oh, yes, Uncle.
He is prompt.
I die with impatience.
He has a fine span of horses, see?
I'm trembling.
Oh, John Hayes! Oh!
You, girl. If your name be Catherine, get in.
Uncle?
Get in, girl, get in.
A kiss, Uncle, for farewell to you and Uncle Ned.
Which we did in tears and kisses the whole night past. Get in, girl, get in.
Here's your money, Lieutenant. Small sackful, as was contracted for. Giddy up!
They were married that night, these impetuous 18th century lovers, these young people, Catherine Hall and John Hayes. History records that it was a rather hectic marriage. The groom's father went temporarily blind from drink before the ceremony. There was unruliness among the servants, and some sources state that the bride herself tried to sneak off and had to be restrained. But married they were just as evening sun went down. And that evening, after the house of John Hayes had quieted down, after the pig had been eaten and the toast drunk, after the celebrants had gone home and the windows bolted and the doors barred, after all these things...
There you are! There you are! Come on out now! There you are! Liberty Bird.
You know what you ought to do.
What?
Join the army.
Join the army?
Join the army.
Why should I do that?
I'd be so proud of you.
Aren't you proud of me now?
Think of you in a uniform.
Oh, I never did.
Well, then let's do it.
All right.
The scarlet trousers and the scarlet coat.
Oh, my.
And the golden sash and the gleaming scabbard.
And I'd stand up straight like this.
On your curly hair, a three-cornered hat and a cockade.
And I'd march. And I'd march.
And perhaps...
What?
They'd send you to America.
Yes. No.
You could volunteer for it.
No. You'd miss me too much. You'd suffer.
Oh, I'd write to you every day.
The boats to America do not sail very often.
I'd knit things for you and bake things for you. But mostly...
What?
I'd be proud. Oh, so proud. Dear John.
Well, I don't know.
Join the army.
Proud?
Yes.
What would you do?
Tell people. John.
Yes.
Golden sash and gleaming scabbard, and on your head a three-cornered hat with a cockade, John. And you'd march so straight and tall, you'd march.
Like this?
Yes.
Like this?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Dear Father, I am writing this letter to tell you that I have just come back from a 20-mile march under full pack, and I do not like it. In the 6 months I have been in the army, I have not found a thing that I like about it. It is march, 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 march. In spite of my education, I am still but a grenadier. Two of the lads who joined the army with me are lieutenants and wear cockades. So, please... Dear Father, present the government with £20 and secure my release from this life. I would do it with my own funds, but I had wisdom enough to assign my wealth to my wife's name before joining the army. I do not wish to bother Catherine in this matter, as I am going to surprise her by my appearance in civilian garb and put an end to her loneliness. Please, Father, do me this favor, your loving son, John. Oh, P.S., please, Father, Just consider it alone.
That curious tailor from Tottenham.
Mr. Wood, you're the one.
And how about me?
Oh, you're a one too, Mr. Billings. If it's the butcher boy, Mr. Wood.
Yeah, I'll send him on his way. Hi.
Who are you?
Who are you?
I am John Hayes.
Who?
John Hayes.
Oh, you be in the army. Oh,
not now. I am John Hayes, and I've come home to my wife. Where is she? Catherine!
Who is it?
Catherine! Catherine, I'm home!
Dirty deserter.
No.
Oh, shame.
Well, listen, I'm out of the army.
But you cannot be. I just sent you a sweater.
I'm out. My father paid a bounty for me, and I'm home again. Who are these men, Catherine?
I'm Billings, the cooper.
I be Wood, the alehouseman.
Tradesman?
Aye.
Well, what do we need a cooper and an alehouseman here?
Are you questioning me, husband?
Well, I'd like to know why a cooper and an alehouseman...
Welcome out!
Aye, welcome out!
Ready here!
Comes well!
Drink a cheer, boys!
Run to hero, comes to well!
Run to hero, comes to well! Comes to well! Comes to well! Comes to well!
Oh, husband. Oh,
dear wife.
I was so proud of you when you were gone.
And you told people.
Oh, yes.
Drink a cheer.
Yeah.
Drink a cheer.
And now, wife.
We will celebrate you and me and Mr. Billings and Mr. Wood.
Well, I
thought. Good. We'll have a celebrate.
John, you're dusty from the road. Go wash. There's a full pail, always a full pail, always waiting for your return. Go wash.
Yes.
Mr. Wood.
Aye, Katie.
Mr. Billings.
How did you come to marry such a one, Kate?
He's very rich.
And he's come home.
His wealth is assigned in my name. I receive it but in driblets.
Poor lady.
Shame.
If I were a widow...
The money?
All at once. All mine.
Billings?
Aye.
Let's make a widow.
And how to do that?
You kill an husband, you make a widow. Ain't that an axe above the fireplace?
Oh, dear friends.
I washed Catherine.
I was proud.
Ruddy hero.
A soldier had come home to his wife, to his neighbors. There was wine in the room and a good fire. But it was one of the shortest celebrations on record. Listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland. This Saturday night, learn the true details of the Wheel of Misfortune case on Gangbusters, when a wheel, gangland terminology for a driver in a crime, runs afoul of the law, he cuts himself out of the crime in question. After the robbery comes off, the wheel declares himself in for a cut of the spoils, and murder results before police clamp the lid on the crooks. Gangbusters, this Saturday night on most of these same stations. The same evening to listen for CBS Radio's thrilling Gunsmoke series. And now once again, Thomas Highland and the second act of Crime Classics. And his report to you on John Hayes, his head, and how they were parted.
Thank you.
Historical background. We are concerned here with England in the early 1700s. George I sat upon the throne, and the terms Whig and Tory were being muttered and bandied about and chalked on walls. During 1 February, the great Sir Hugh Verdeny took time away from the Navy, went ashore long enough to invent the side pocket, only to die a year later in the Fijis. And in April, a month which concerns us most, King George put his queen in prison because of her part in the von Königsmark affair. But we are concerned most with a citizen of the time, Mr. John Hayes. We hear of him next on the evening of April 22nd. Two lovers who had never heard of him strolled along the Thames. Strolled.
Let's sit here, Duck.
No, Thomas.
So they strolled on.
Mary. Duck. Let's sit here.
Oh, no.
And on.
I like it here beneath the bridge, don't you?
Well...
See how the shadows lie like lacy web?
Where?
Yon.
Oh.
Let us sit and watch and see how they quiver as riding moon, a trail in the sky.
Here?
Just so. Mary, Duck, you are dear to me.
Hush.
And how to wash this torrent inside me. Fair Mary, fairest and most lovely. And now the blushes to your cheek beneath the moon.
Thomas.
Yes, Mary. I too.
Thomas.
This is an unreality which we see, Mary. A conjugation of shadow and moonlight and...
But it has such curly hair.
Lacy shadows.
And eyes and lips that grin. A head with no body. There in the mud.
It'll go away.
How can it? It's an abomination. Come...
It's not real.
It is real.
It is not.
Go see.
Duck.
Go see.
All right.
Well?
Go.
A head?
Of a man.
Of a curly-headed man. I knew it. Thomas Ascot, I did not want to come down here in the first place. You made me. You made me.
A head? Go.
So they discovered the head in the mud of the Thames, and after they married, they had a lot to talk about. It was the head of John Hayes, all right, but nobody knew it then. Thomas Ascot reported his unusual find to the constabulary, who went to the spot, saw that the lad was indeed a truthful lad, poked about searching for a body to go with the head, failed, and then brought back what had been found to the sheriff's offices. They cleaned and combed the find, known as dressing the head in the trade. Then they mounted it neatly on a 10-foot pole. This was the custom of the day. Whenever an extra head was found, mount it on a pole, exhibit it in the town square so it could be identified. Nobody, however, came forward in the prescribed 3 days, so Dom Llewellyn was called in. Do that thing you do with glass, Dom, he was told, with heads, and close this one for preservation purposes. And Dom did, with caliper and a secretly fashioned glass and blowpipe. And Tom did. In the meanwhile, back at the home of Catherine Hayes, she's just stepped out of her door on her way to the cheese stall.
Mrs. Hayes! Woo! Mrs. Hayes!
Good morning to you, Mrs. Martin.
Good morning to you. A marketing?
A marketing.
Mind you if I go along, if I walk with you.
Neighbor who walks alone, neighbor's alone.
Aye. Wise was the poet who first said that. Mrs. Hayes.
Yes?
A question.
Ninny do.
How go your two boarders?
A pace.
So?
Yes.
Mr. Wood is an attractive one. Wouldn't you say?
In truth, I had not noticed.
Nonny, nonny, nonny.
In truth?
I suppose you'll say you have not noticed the prettiness of Mr. Billings.
Not at all. Through the goodness of my heart for poor tradesmen, they live in my cellar. Truth, I never see them.
And Mr. Hayes, your husband?
Of him what?
I have not seen him. I heard he has returned from the army, but I have not seen him.
No wonder.
No wonder?
If he is on his way to Portugal, how could you see him?
How indeed? But Mrs. Hayes...
Yes?
So long he was in the army, then home to such a young and comely as you, then within 4 days he offs to Portugal.
Oh, restless John. My last words to him as he left.
Restless indeed. Huh. Would that my husband were restless like that, and off to Portugal. And a cooper like that Mr. Billings about. Some has all the lucky.
And Mrs. Martin shook her head sadly all the way to the cheese stalls. There, she selected a good round Edam and went home and told all the neighbors that John Hayes had hied off to Portugal. And neighbors told neighbors, and everybody was satisfied. For a week. For it was a week later that Mrs. Martin went down to London on a visit to a friend. It was an infrequent trip for Mrs. Martin, and her friend took her around to show her the sights, the finest statuary, the best inns, and on a Sunday afternoon, he took her to see a head, which had been encapsulated by Dom Llewellyn, and which was on exhibition at the Constabulary Museum. And seeing it, Mrs. Martin said this.
Why, I do believe I know that man.
And her friend took her to the sheriff, to whom she repeated herself.
Why, I do believe I know that man.
What man?
Why, the man in that room there. The one whose head's in the glass.
You know him, you say?
Did he?
You're certain?
Did he? Did he do?
Who is he?
A neighbor to me. Husband to a young lass. Poor lass.
Ah?
Poor lass, barely 17, I'd say. And her husband dead in such a way.
Who is she? What's her name?
Catherine. Catherine Hayes. And he who you've got like you've got is her hubby, dear. John Hayes. I be confused, I be.
How?
What's he doing in that room, like he is, when he's in Portugal?
What's he doing there, indeed? Madam.
I?
Will you take me to your neighbor?
Didi? Didi, I will.
Katie and I?
We've had enough of you around, Katie and I.
You.
What say you, Katie?
Oh, settle it between you.
Listen to me, alehouse man. I'd as soon slit your gullet as look at you. And I'll do it if you don't leave us alone.
Talking. It's all you're good at, Billings. Come to me so I can let the air out of you with a knife.
Oi! Oh,
settle it between you.
You!
Yes, who be you?
Sheriff of London Town.
For what?
If you be Mrs. John Hayes, I come to take you with me.
For what?
To show you of your husband, if he be the one whose head we have.
Head?
Aye. And madam?
Aye.
The two men I espy over your shoulder, may I inquire of their worth?
Friends to me.
And your husband?
I would say so.
We will all ride down to London Town. And now, Mr. Wood, I will show you a thing. Come with me. Look, you... Who is this man whose head is in this glass?
I do not know.
Who is this man?
I do not know. I swear it. I am a pious man. When I swear a thing, it is sworn to. And it is the truth.
Very well. Sit there. Mr. Billings? Close the door, please. Walk to that table, Mr. Billings, and tell me whose head it is encased there. Mr. Billings?
Aye.
What have you done with the rest of Mr. Hayes?
Mr. Hayes?
Did you put an axe in such a way as to sever his head?
Me?
You?
No.
Very well. Sit there. Mrs. Hayes, please. Is that your husband's head who is on the table?
No.
You are not looking at the head, Mrs. Hayes.
Nor do I need to. For my beloved husband, my strength and my love is in Portugal.
Mrs. Hayes.
What?
Will you look at the head, please?
I will not.
I will bring it to you so you can see.
Do not.
For what reason?
Do not. Do not. Do not. Do not. How can it be my hubby loved John when he isn't?
Pretend, Mrs. Hayes. Pretend he is not in Portugal, and so pretending, tell me, is this your husband?
No.
Are you sure?
It is not my husband.
Perhaps you need a better look.
No, no, it is not John, not him.
I hold him by the hair and close to you. Now tell me.
John. John, hubby love.
Your husband.
Yes, yes, oh, yes.
And how got he here?
They did it. Billings and Wood.
Say, liar!
No shame and no lies. You, the two of you evil men, killed him and severed his head.
Aye, while you fetched the pail to catch his head.
And laughed as you caught it.
In the name of his majesty, I charge the three of you.
Charge them, not me.
The three of you.
And the three of them were tried. Billings and Wood on the charge of murder. Catherine on the charge of petty treason, which was 18th century talk for killing one's husband. All were found guilty. Wood died in jail. Billings was hung in chains. And Catherine, let me read to you from a journal of the times concerning Catherine. An iron chain was placed about her body and fixed to a stake. On these occasions, when women were burned for petty treason, it was customary to strangle them by means of a rope passed round the neck and pulled by the executioner, so that they were dead before the flames reached the body. But the flames leaped so high that the executioner burned his hands, so that he could not strangle, so that Catherine Hayes was burned alive. It is interesting to note that a graph of petty treason in England for a whole year after that shows a decided drop before it picks up again. In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's crime classic. John Hayes, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Betty Harford was heard as Catherine, Jeanette Nolan as Mrs. Martin, and Alastair Duncan as John Hayes. Featured in the cast were Ben Wright,
Richard Peel, Charles Davis, and William Johnstone. Bob Lamond speaking. Here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, Mahadwat, India, in the year 1894. We will concern ourselves with a father and son who just didn't get along, to the point where one of them had to go. My report to you will be on Rashi among the crocodiles and the prank he played. Thank you. Good night.
From the stars of old Vienna to Rodgers and Hammerstein, hear a cavalcade of musical treats illustrating how easy it is to become stage-struck the Broadway musical way with Guy Bolton and P.G. Wodehouse as guides. Hear the evolution of musical comedy Friday night when CBS Radio presents Stage Struck. Lionel Barrymore's Radio Hall of Fame is great Sunday night drama on the CBS Radio Network.
These crimes didn't pay, but they certainly make interesting listening. Thank you for listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. Join me again next week as we continue our radio crime spree. I'm your host, Justine Ward, saying so long for now.